Hello, everyone. Welcome to Distillery Sessions, the podcast from Distillery. My name is Peter Hoffer, and I'll be your host for today's Distillery Session. Now, today I'm joined by Robin Bond, founder of Codefinery. And today we are talking about developing a business proposition for fans and improving client-agency relationships. So, welcome, Robin.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm delighted to be invited onto the podcast.
No, we are glad to have you. Now, if our listeners didn't get a chance to hear the broad discussion that Robin took place, we'll make sure to point you to that webinar, because that was a really great conversation all about pivoting and brands. So to kick off, maybe if Robin, you could give a bit of background about you and Codefinery.
Very happy to. So Codefinery is a management consultancy specifically serving the agency market. So I spend my days working with founders and chief execs of agency businesses, ultimately to drive growth. But it's really about trying to find the shortest course between where the agency is at today, which sometimes needs a bit of definition, and exactly where they're headed as well. And then just, as I say, getting between where they are and where they need to be as quickly as possible. So it's a really privileged position. I get to spend my time talking with business owners and really understanding where their particular hurdles are and trying to make something tangible happen very quickly. So it's a good way to meet a lot of great people.
No, it must be quite fascinating to speak with people of all different backgrounds, all different industries that you may not be sort of able to talk to on a daily basis.
Absolutely, because you know those agencies they're hugely varied in terms of scale and maturity and geography and ownership model. You know, running an agency is not a particularly complicated endeavor. You've got to know what business you're in. You've got to be able to secure money from that market, and you've got to be able to turn that money into profit. So the sort of operational efficiency part of it as well. So that's pretty consistent across agencies, regardless of the discipline you're in or the, as I say, the age of the business or the scale of it. But obviously the nuances come in thick and fast in terms of personalities and constraints and politics. And so every client is different. I learn loads off of every agency business I work with, which again is a privileged position to be in. And it's always different. You know, every agency is different, despite the fact that the way they articulate their problems, whether it's about, dissatisfaction with the speed with which they're growing, or a pointed issue around, an operational challenge or a growth challenge or a profit challenge or a pricing challenge. It's as I say, every conversation leads to the learnings for me. And hopefully it means that the advice and the guidance that Codefinery provides is always very tailored. And that's really important to me. So it's a fun way to earn a living.
No, I think that's where perhaps the value comes in, of just that personalized message, that you're not just doing a sort of copy paste job to everyone you speak with.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, again, you build up learnings and you build up IP, and there's a few frameworks that that Codefinery uses that are proprietary. But as with most things, the application of those tools, the way that they guide the conversation, that's really all they do. They provide some clarity around getting from A to B, but they don't solve it for you. And that's why every solution is different. And quite frankly, every consultancy business should be saying similar things, in my view. Once it becomes cookie cutter, then it's the sort of thing you can share in a blog post and people can pick up and use. And and you should, the more you share, the more you get, I think. So you're bang on about that.
No, makes sense. So one of the topics I wanted to get your views on is about fans and fandom, because I think especially now with customer behavior is quite up in the air. It's quite different that brands are spending more, I guess, more focus, more attention, more love and care to their fans. So I guess to begin with, how would you define what a fan is?
It's a really interesting question for me, because I'm a big fan of language, which means I'm part pedant rather than anything else. But I do get quite frustrated sometimes with language, because language gets overused very quickly and it becomes very generic very quickly. I think there's lots of language we're all kind of annoyed hearing too much of lately, whether it's the word unprecedented or new normal or pivot. They start to become pretty meaningless. One of the reasons it frustrates me is because a lot of the language in and around agency businesses has been quite genericized. There's a lot of convergence between agency disciplines around what you could broadly describe as the customer experience. And those terms, you know, digital transformation being another, they start to become so widely applied and used so often, it's like just sort of confetti or word soup. So I do think generally we need to be a little bit more intentional with the way that we use language like this. So the definition of a fan, again, I make no claim in any of the language I use to have the sort of dictionary definition version of it. But for me, and this is just a personal sort of perspective, I guess, as much as a consumer, as a real person, as much as someone in the business. I don't know, I feel like being a fan, if you have fans as a brand, maybe you have credit in the bank, you know, it's a bit, I guess, a bit like a friendship, you know, you are prepared to be forgiving when things go wrong, you know, you are willing to give the benefit of the doubt. And ultimately, you know, as we look at back into sort of marketing language as sort of being a customer goes into loyalty, goes into advocacy. I think having a genuine emotional connection, that's probably where that fan sits in my head. I think maybe, you know, perhaps customer is a transactional thing. You know, I'd probably go to the supermarket that's closest to my house, for example. It's maybe more price or practicality driven, and it maybe lacks that emotional connection. But I think there's definitely a benefit to it. You know, in an economic sense, it's certainly, I'm sure, cheaper to keep a fan as a customer than it is to find new customers and build them into fans. So, a customer lifetime value point of view. I think perhaps, again, particularly now, we're clearly in an age of transparency. I don't know if you saw Ben and Jerry's response to the crisis in the US.
Yes, quite bold, but it sort of fit in with their brand, because I think, you know, going back to your point earlier of building up credit in the bank, we know that, you know, Ben and Jerry's is very, you know, passionate about social issues. So I guess seeing that, if you were quite familiar with Ben and Jerry's, it wasn't that out of step to what they stand for.
And I think that consistency, it serves them well. It's a bit like looking back at politicians' voting records when they become, you know, and they come to prominence. We see what they're really about by looking back at what they've done. So, you know, Ben and Jerry's is an FMCG brand, but they clearly have a passionate set of beliefs, and they're willing to use the platforms that they have. And I think increasingly brands, you know, in this day and age are providing as much of a leadership position as are, you know, what you might call influencers. They're the ones that shape public opinion as much or probably far more so than government. So, yes, I think if you are building fandom as a brand, you're in a far better position to capitalize on, you know, responsibility, or even you might argue an obligation to play some role in shaping and evolving public values towards what, you know, effectively becomes a more decent world. So, I think fandom is it's a simple word, but it leans into some quite big issues for me.
And I think that's, you know, to your point earlier of really defining it, I think, you know, perhaps that's where that clarity between a brand and an agency really, you know, takes shape of making sure that both sides understand what exactly the key terms are, the key goals are, which I guess leads me to my next question of how would you define, you know, what a good client and agency relationship is?
it's such a good question. I mean, it's like any other relationship, isn't it? I mean, it's you look at your personal relationships, whether they're friendships or romantic relationships, your relationships with your colleagues, all that kind of stuff. You know, there is clearly no one dictionary definition for these things. And you get to good outcomes broadly just by being aligned, but also by just talking about it. So there are fundamental things that make for a good client agency relationship, which I'm sure no one would disagree with, you know, trust, respect, listening to one another, as you say, clarity, you know, just common decency and manners. It's not, none of that stuff is rocket science. So I suppose for me, it, in terms of creating that kind of relationship, for me, it's more about both sides being very honest about what constitutes good. So that for me kind of boils down to fit. I think agencies are very good at claiming they're very good at everything. And actually the world and brands and probably fans would be better served by there being a little bit more honesty about where capabilities and expertise begin and end. So
sure.
I'll give you an example. So when you moved to where you lived, you probably needed to register with a doctor. So I dare say if you're like most people, you probably just looked up in, you know, the kind of the locality to find the GPs that were closest to you. You probably chose the one that was closest because it was easiest. Didn't want to have a long way to walk when you're feeling poorly. And if you go and see that doctor a few times, you know, they've got obviously some good broad skills. They're general practitioners after all, but you know, those skills are quite widely available. So if you go to that doctor and they're, you know, three visits out of five, they're quite rude to you, or they're a bit dismissive of your children or whatever it's going to be, it wouldn't take a huge amount of stimulus before you decided, you know what, life's too short, I'm going to go find a doctor that's maybe 100 yards further from my house or something like that.
Yeah.
If you compare that to a very different situation where you've got a much more acute issue, which is better defined. So let's say you needed a back surgeon or something like that. The way that you choose that specialist would be very different. You would probably search much harder. You would be much clearer on credentials. You'd probably be happy to travel further. You know, you might even pay for it if you wanted to go private to speed the process up. You'd go through whatever, you know, sort of selection process that specialist laid down, whether it's a long waiting list or you know, whatever else. So, and then if you went to see that surgeon and you said to them, you know, I've got this problem with my back, and they were just as rude or sniffy with you, and had a lack of bedside manner like the doctor, like the GP did, you would probably take it on the chin at that point. And the difference being is that you really need that surgeon at that moment. You've put more work in to get in front of them. You are effectively scarce, and they're difficult to find an alternative at that point in time. So I think that dynamic is something which is quite important when we're talking about the fit between clients and agencies. Because if you claim to do everything, if you claim to be a generalist, then people will treat you as a disposable resource. Whereas if you are demonstrably an expert, then, you know, if you're an expert agency, clients will treat you as an expert that's hard to replace. So again, what makes a good client agency relationship? Well, if agencies stop claiming to do everything and chasing every CMO with a budget and saying, oh yeah, of course we can do that, and then working out, you know, how to do it on the way back to the office, then I think some good things will happen in relationships. And again, from the client side, you know, I think they have to be increasingly willing to let expert agencies lead the process. A sort of one size fits all kind of buying process doesn't help them get the best out of agencies that have real specialism. So again, when I write about this stuff in Marketing Week, we're always keen to try and emphasize both sides of that debate. Where what can agencies do differently? Be more focused. What can clients do differently? Let agencies demonstrate their expertise rather than putting them in a box.
Yeah. And I guess maybe that's a bit of a big step for clients to actually let go a bit and let someone else in the driver's seat when you perhaps are very protective of your brand or quite invested. So that must be, you know, quite a mind shift for a client when they enter that relationship with a new agency.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about this recently, actually, about the sort of nature of the word partnership. And it is a bit of a woolly term. Because again, the sort of partnership involves risk and it involves trust and some of those aspects we've touched on in terms of the client agency relationship, but it is a more sort of particular version of that. So the problem with partnership is that both sides' view kind of differ on what it means.
Yes.
back to words again and my horrendous pedantry, but I think it's a thing. You know, agencies often use the word partnership as a sort of synonym for just basic collaboration and human decency. I think
often
that's almost a sort of shorthand cry for help, because a lot of agencies feel quite browbeaten by clients, whether that's ridiculous payment terms or being asked to quote for something super vague on a Friday night and, you know, basic stuff.
Yes.
I think often you talk to clients about partnership, you talk to procurement people about what strategic partnership looks like, and it's much more rooted in the commercials. So is there some kind of payment by results mechanism, which, as an aside, is very different to value-based pricing and value-based selling, but that's a whole other conversation. But But if it is rooted in the commercials and that's where partnership lives, then you have to ask yourself the question as an agency, do you really want to be in partnership with all your clients? Do you trust them to be able to do their bit in order for you to get paid that bit more or to get, hit the money that you've agreed? So I think partnership can be both of those things. It can just be about collaboration and the nature of the working relationship. It can be rooted in the commercials, but it's more subtle and it requires more bespoke definition. It's grounded in that whole piece around scarcity and risk. So the fear factor, if you like, that you talked about with clients having to cede a little bit more control to their agencies and let experts do their thing. This absolutely is based on, I suppose, the client's sense of jeopardy that they can't get that expertise elsewhere. So
yes,
there's a sort of functional scarcity that is this the agency, the only, one of the few agencies that's capable of doing what I need? Do I believe, they're not conflicted, they have the scale to do this. But more interestingly, it's that kind of qualitative scarcity. How much risk does the client feel? Could a cheaper agency do this as well? Am I paying over the odds? Do they have skills and experience that make me trust them that they can do this better than anybody else? And I think that's the great imperative, for agencies, is to demonstrate that they have these things, because then they earn the right to be trusted. They earn the right to work in partnership, and they earn the right to, again, to your point, to earn the trust that allows them to do their best work, because they're leading the engagement in the same way that, you wouldn't be leaning over the surgeon's shoulder saying, are you sure you want to use that scalpel? Maybe you should use a different one, or maybe you should do this double quickly, or maybe I wouldn't use that many stitches. It's nonsense. You wouldn't tell your pilot how to fly the plane. So we're very willing to cede to experts in other aspects of our lives, but agencies should be the experts, but they're very good at kind of handing that power back to the client. And I don't think that helps get to the great outcomes we've talked about.
No, very true. It's funny that you've mentioned that term partnership, because I admit I've used that when I was on the client side of using that term when working with my agencies. And I think, I keep thinking, why did I use that term specifically? And I think because other terms just seem to have that power dynamic embedded in the term. And I thought by using partnership, I would, as a client, show that we're in this together, we have shared goals, but sometimes that wasn't quite clear within my team, but also with the agency as well, what I meant by using that term.
Well, it's a really interesting thing. I was having a conversation with an intermediary the other day, and we got talking about this nature of partnership, and he's done a lot of work with procurement teams, as you can imagine. And one of the sort of dynamics of partnership, even if there's no sort of obvious skin in the game, payment by results aspect, which, as we all know, is relatively hard to be implemented on both sides. So even if that's not in place, a lot of procurement people will look at strategic partnership. And it seems to kind of boil down to, do we pay the agency what they asked for? And it's like, okay, is there enough scarcity here? Is there enough trust that they'll deliver? Is there enough sort of reason why we're being charged what we're charging? Are we going to say, they've asked for £1 million, we're going to give them £1 million, or we're going to try and beat them up and get them down to 750? And will the agency descope accordingly, or will they just take the hit? Will they have already built in a buffer knowing that they're going to get asked for a pound of flesh? There's all this noise going on around what is a fair price for a good outcome, which is why, again, sort of touched on this earlier, sort of selling on value, which I don't mean payment by results, but just simply pricing your services based on a hard and soft set of metrics about the value that's going to be created, is a really good way of changing the conversation with brands and with procurement people as agencies, because it just takes it away from inputs and time and materials, which don't serve anybody's purpose, and gets it to, what's a fair price for what we're going to deliver. And if you're having that kind of grown-up conversation, then, frankly, hourly rates stop making any sense, because the client wants the thing you're delivered quickly, which is great. You want to deliver it quickly, because the sooner you do it, the sooner you get paid. So that would tend to suggest an incredibly high hourly rate. But if the client wants to put a very low hourly rate in a box somewhere because of corporate governance, and fair enough if they do, then just say it'll take twice as long, and that will bring down the hourly rate. and it won't serve either party to do it that much more slowly. So the whole sort of inputs and time and materials argument around pricing is it's a very interesting debate, and it starts to get quite counterproductive if you get too far into it. So again, whole another podcast based on that. But if you're looking at looking at partnership, then you know, look at some of the conditions that create those grown-up conversations that allow you to define what meaningful collaborative working relationships and potentially partnerships mean. I think that's a one-to-one endeavor that can only be is only likely when, you know, you can't be a partner if you're seen as a commodity. And I think that's probably the that's my bottom line on the subject.
Very true. So you know, we are entering, I think, third month of lockdown, where you know, haven't seen my office in many months. So I'm interested to hear what you know, how do you think the coronavirus situation is affecting the client agency relationship? Is it more than just lack of face to face meetings?
It's interesting. I hope this might be a bit of a watershed. I mean, obviously the whole pandemic has been a dreadful thing and continues to be a dreadful thing, but just, you know, within the confines of the question, you know, the clients are under a lot of pressure. We've read a lot about the sort of acceleration of digital transformation and the move towards digital channels. You know, I think a lot of the public spaces that are closed, you know, museums and so on, have done some brilliant work in not just kind of creating virtual tours or creating, you know, teaching resources. So it's been a time that's sort of shown us all that we can do stuff that and, you know, do it more quickly than perhaps we have in the past. And obviously working from home or working remotely is another example of that. But I think in terms of the relationship, when clients are under pressure, they've actually been easier to get hold of, it seems to be. You know, they're at their desks all the time, except when they're running around after children, but perhaps more willing to listen. And to your point again about the sort of trust to cede control a little bit, I think for plenty of clients that are perhaps a little bit more open to changing processes or being more nimble than they would be before, being less sort of slavishly devoted to, you know, heavyweight procurement processes. Not to say that governance has gone away, but perhaps there's just a little bit more flexibility within it. And I think that's probably a good lesson to both parties, if we can let that sort of expertise, the kind of cream rise to the top. So from an agency point of view, I guess I hope that we've had an enormous reminder that when you're talking about particularly marketing and new business, so the sales side of agency life, empathy is absolutely essential. And I found it, again, if I'm honest, quite dispiriting that so much of the advice around agency new business at the moment is that, you know, oh, we've really changed how we're marketing the agency, we're much more content led, we're not so hard sell. It's like, why were you hard sell for so long? You know, this idea that, oh, well, in difficult times, you know, selling becomes helping. It's like, no, all of the time, it always was selling is helping. So I think the opportunity out of coronavirus in terms of the client agency relationship, it is, again, everyone has a better sense of how to get to a really strong fit. Be honest about what the requirements are, be honest about whether your agency can do it, have grown up conversations about how that might work. And that is a great way to lead to better outcomes more quickly. Hopefully that's what, you know, the whole kind of new set of constraints under which everyone's operating has shown.
Sure. I think, are there, so you mentioned, you know, the sales challenges for new business for agencies. Are there, you know, in your conversations with agencies, are there any other big concerns that they've, you know, they've come to you for advice when, you know, during this lockdown period?
Yeah, interesting. I think that's changed. I think at the start, a lot of the questions were about, should we even be doing new business right now? It felt quite tone deaf, if you like, to be overtly selling. And I think that was a symptom of what we've talked about, this idea that selling is inherently about what you've got to sell. And clearly that's nonsense. And I think the penny dropped, and it was never about, we've got these things to sell, we've got experience in your market, please can we come and talk to you, we've won awards. You know, at best, that's a very inefficient way of selling an agency. And once you stop thinking about the agency and start thinking about the client, all of a sudden selling, in inverted commas, makes more sense, because again, you're clearly just helping the client get from A to B. So that, I think, passed, and agencies started to recognize that they, if they were empathetic and if they could feel like they were genuinely offering assistance to help clients and prospects through a difficult time, then that kind of should we be selling question just went away, because it was obvious that you should always be helping. Just, you know, the things you're helping them do change given on the situation. So I think what has emerged quite clearly after that is that there's a lot of trends in and around the agency space, you know, as they relate to clients, obviously, that I think have dramatically accelerated. So, you know, changes to the way that clients buy, you know, evolutions in the way that agencies go to market, you know, getting beyond this sense of, you know, if you need to grow an agency, you've got to win new clients. Well, that's not the only way to grow an agency. Well, if you're going to grow the agency and you need new clients, the only way to do that is to pitch. That's not true either. So there's a lot of sort of old school thinking that, well, if you're going to grow an agency, you've got to get on as many pitch lists as you can. That's utter nonsense for lots of reasons. I mean, you can put your prices up, you can grow your clients, mm-hmm. but agencies are far more excited by new business than existing clients, which I think is probably one of those sort of knee-jerk traditional mindsets that's perhaps been compromised a bit by, you know, by coronavirus, because they've recognized they needed to stay much closer to their clients rather than trying to start new relationships. So I do think that you know, the kind of upshot of that, agencies are maybe, I mean, certainly what I'm the conversations I'm having, they're largely about doing things that they know they've been needing to do for a while, but are now recognizing that the need to do them has become more acute. There's more urgency in transforming those agency businesses. You know, the things they've been putting off are, right, we really need to stand out more than we do. You know, we know that our story is so generic. We've got to sort that out. I think the need to be more focused.
Yeah.
You know, obviously very related to stand out. I think agencies are realizing they need to be a little bit more deliberate with what they do and what they don't do. So, as I say, choosing an actual target audience rather than, I think I said this earlier,
sure.
You know, any senior marketeer with money in sectors we're not conflicted, that's not a strategy, and it never was. And sort of rethinking the nature of specialization. It's specialized doesn't just mean you work in one sector or that you work in one discipline. Specialization doesn't mean small. It could be massive. So I think just having a bit more of a sophisticated view about how you can be focused and how you can develop propositions which can be tightly defined but not naturally limiting, I think that is, as I say, a more progressive way of growing an agency business. And that's a lot of what I'm being asked about right now.
Think about ourselves just in our home environments of, you know, now that we're spending more time within these four walls, we notice things that we can improve or things to make our current situation better. And I guess that's the same with agency side.
100%.
Well, Robin, I think we've spoken quite, we've covered a lot, and I think we are coming close to the end of our allotted time. But before we get, finish, have a couple of quick questions that we've asked all of our interviewees at these distillery sessions. So the first question I have for you is, what was the last thing you recommended to a friend or family member? Now, this could be something like it could be a Netflix show or a new band or a new recipe you discovered.
Wow. The thing I've recommended endlessly over the last 3 months, and this isn't coronavirus related, but just happens to be when it was introduced to me, it is exactly a Netflix show. This is worth the Netflix fee on its own, is a show called Archer. It's an animated show. If you haven't seen it, it's like a piss take on the sort of spy genre. He's kind of like a womanizing, hard drinking James Bond character. It's rude. It's funny. It's like 20 minutes long, and it's just so well written. I think it's one of these shows written by a single writer. Yeah. So it's really snappy. The dialogue's great, and it's just got so many subtle, you know, sort of language jokes in it. So as a language pedant, it's right up my street. So yeah, love it. Definitely Archer. Go watch it.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm a big fan of that as well. A friend of mine actually recommended that to me, and he was a English lit major, and so we just discuss all of their references. So I remember one episode, Archer was, he mentioned Animal Farm, and they had this argument of whether it's a parable or whether it's a story. And but it's, you know, as you said, it works on so many levels. It's very much like The Simpsons, I think.
It really does. I mean, back when The Simpsons was good, 100%.
Exactly. Yes. First six or seven seasons. And my next question is, what are you a fan of that might surprise most people? Now, this could be something like, professional wrestling or knitting. So what's something that would surprise most people?
Oh, blimey. I don't know about what would surprise people, but I can juggle. That's like a hidden skill. I'm a fan of pencil drawing. That's a thing. So that's something I used to do a lot when I was a kid and then maybe stopped when I was about 10 or 12, but had a bit more time under lockdown because I wasn't commuting. So something I've got back into and got back into in a big way. In fact, again, as a sort of Corona related sort of silver lining thing, I got chatting with a guy on LinkedIn who'd also spent 30 years or so not drawing, and we ended up having a chat, and he's an art teacher who lives in Yorkshire, and we've chatted a bit and exchanged work, and he gives me tips and I'm absolutely in awe of his work. My drawing's really come on, actually, so I'm quite pleased about that.
Have you seen on iPlayer there are live drawing classes that BBC have started to
I did one of them, and I've never done any live drawing in my life, and my god, it was hard because they made you do sketches really quickly, and I'm like a again, as the sort of language pedant in me, I think I hide behind precision with the drawing as well, so it takes me a long time to do it, and I'm quite scientific about it, and there's I use a ruler as much as a pencil, and to sort of draw quickly and very organically when they say, right, you've got 30 seconds to draw this figure. And it's like, what, 30 seconds? I can barely pick up a pencil in 30 seconds. So, but it was really fun to challenge myself in that way. have you tried it as well?
No, I'm just, I've been discovering all the new offerings via iPlayer. So a lot more documentaries, a lot more, educational films, which I've been watching more on, sort of art history is what I've been watching lately. Cool.
You should do a recommendations podcast as well. We could bang on about, favorite episodes of The Simpsons or, different kinds of pencils to draw with or, history documentaries. We could spend hours on this.
Yes. Well, when it comes to pencils, when I went to Japan, a friend of mine took me to helped me discover all these stationery stores, and I could have packed a whole suitcase of nice paper and all that back from Japan.
Oh, my kids would love that, especially my youngest. Should be in heaven.
All right. Okay, so Robin, if people wanted to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
So the Codefinery website is just codefinery.com, which is CODEFINERY, codefinery.com. I am on LinkedIn, as you might be not surprised to find out. And I'm also on Twitter at RobonN. So come along and say hi.
Well, definitely do say hello to Robin if you're online. But Robin, once again, thanks for joining me today. And thank you everyone for listening. Now, if you want to follow Distillery on our socials, we are at We Are Distillery, and we look forward to welcoming you to our next episode soon. Thanks, everyone.